Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Tom Butler.
I'm Brendan Duffy.
And I'm Tom Wheatley.
And you're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us as three lifelong 007 fans go on a journey of discovery.
We're on a mission to discover everything we can about cinema's greatest spy films.
By learning about the people who made them, in front of the camera and behind.
The James Bond A to Z podcast is in no way affiliated with James Bond, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We've researched each episode as extensively as we can, but our information does come from a range of sources. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we can get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast, where we have reached the letter K. My name is Tom Butler, and joining me as we explore the filmmakers and characters from the world of 007 that fall under the 11th letter of the alphabet is a man who almost certainly knows what chemical element is represented by the letter K. It's Mr. Brendan Duffy.
Do I have to answer that?
Yeah, go on, do you know it?
Potassium. No.
Yeah,
okay. No, potassium, yeah. Is it potassium?
Yes.
Bananas.
Exactly. And by his side is a man who can probably tell me the name of the band whose debut album, K, was released in 1996 and featured the hit singles Grateful When You're Dead, Hey Dude and Tapvar. It's Mr. Tom Wheatley.
No, I'm not going to be able to answer that, am I?
You don't know it.
Music.
Brendan, you got it?
No.
Top Loader.
Cooler Shaker.
Why don't you give us Hush? I'd have known it with Hush.
I don't think it was on their debut album. I think it was a single, but...
Fair enough.
There we go. So,
definitely not Top Loader.
If this is the first time you've listened to the James Bond A to Z podcast, we don't normally start with a question and answer round, but welcome. This is
More of those, please.
This is a one of our letter episodes in which we'll be talking about the some of the key creatives and characters from the 007 films, all whose names start with the letter K. And we're going to be mixing things up a little bit this week. It's not all in strictly alphabetical order, but to kick things off, let's hand over to Brendan, who's going to tell us all about a composer who worked on a Timothy Dalton film.
So K is for Kamen, Michael Kamen, and he was a composer who was born in 1948 in New York. He had a fantastic career, spanning a lot of films, that both of you are going to know and love, but not realise it was him that composed them. He started off young. He actually started playing the piano from the age of 2, and then that progressed. He went on to study oboe at the Juilliard School. And the Juilliard School is like where loads of famous composers go, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. While he was there, he formed the New York Rock and Roll Ensemble, which their main aim was to fuse together rock and classical music, something that he would do throughout the rest of his career. They made an album called Roll Over, which was regarded very well. They did a lot of collaborations and they were around for 7 years. And then after they split, Michael Kamen was then invited to write a score for the ballet, for the Harkness Ballet, to which David Bowie attended the premiere. And he saw that. He was impressed. He recruited him as the music director of his Diamond Dogs tour.
Wow.
Mm. So, again, Bowie's someone who experiments with all genre of music, so it worked well. So that became what Michael Kamen like I said, his career was rock and classical music, fusing it together, a bit of his sort of, it was his specialism, which meant he went on to work with Pink Floyd, Queen, Eric Clapton, Roger Daltrey, Aerosmith, Tom Petty, Bon Jovi, Brian Ferry, Eurythmics, Metallica, Def Leppard, The Cranberries, Bryan Adams, Coldplay, Sting, Guns N' Roses and Kate Bush. So
wow.
He was highly regarded in the world of music. With that, he got a big following and obviously he moved into films. So in terms of the films that he scored, Brazil, that was one of his early ones, Three Musketeers, Highlander, X-Men, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which is obviously huge, and that's the one that most of...
Did they release a soundtrack called Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves? Because that would have been really quite... I'd buy that.
Yeah, you can say it all you want, but I'm going to edit that out, so your little witticism won't be in there.
I'll edit it back in.
He did the Lethal Weapon series, the first three Die Hards, The Iron Giant, Memento, and also in terms of TV, one of my favourite scores, The Band of Brothers, series on HBO, which is an excellent, it sets the tone just right. But of course, in between that, in 1989, when they were making License to Kill, they were looking for a composer because, if you remember, if you go back to the John Barry episode, I can't remember what he choked on. He choked on something, didn't he? He got injured. His throat got injured. He had to have throat surgery. So he was unavailable for License to Kill. So Michael Kamen was hot property at the time. So they got him on board to sort of complement that sound that Barry had created and add to it. So in terms of the theme song, he originally planned for it to be an instrumental, much like on Her Majesty's Secret Service. So it would have been just an instrumental. And he got Eric Clapton and Vic Flick. Now, Vic Flick is the guitarist on the original James Bond theme. He got them in and they wrote a theme. And they even shot a video for it, gave it to the producers, and they instead decided to go with Gladys Knight.
Oh, what a shame.
Now, it's been lost. No one knows where it is apart from Michael Kamen. And unfortunately, Vic Flick says... The track was excellent. There have been many attempts to find the recording and the video we shot, but to no avail. With the passing of Michael Kamen, the chances of finding it are slim. Many Bond aficionados are trying to find it, and I wish you luck. So apparently it's out there, probably somewhere in those massive archives.
Mm. That's that sort of that exciting hidden world of these things that existed a long time ago that will never happen for younger people, will it? Because anything that ever gets made now is instantly uploaded to something and you can hear it straight away.
Yeah.
So, that's something that young people will never quite understand in future generations.
What is this? Old Grumpy Men podcast?
Oh, you just got me thinking.
But I would love to have a listen to that. That would be great. So his soundtrack, I mean, it's really... The problem with him doing so much, working with so many people and these films, is in terms of interviews, he rarely talks about License to Kill because everything else...
There's so much to talk about. Yeah.
So no one really asks about that. So you can't really get an interview from him. And sadly, he passed away in 2003. So other stuff he did, conducted music for the Olympic Games in 96 for the Summer Olympics and 2002 for the Winter Olympics. Kamen was diagnosed with MS in 1996, but he continued working. Unfortunately, he had a heart attack in 2003, so he sadly died. But his career is quite understated, under the radar, isn't it?
Hmm.
But once you know that he composed Die Hard, Lethal Weapon, Robin Hood... and License to Kill, it makes sense because they've definitely got a similar sound.
Definitely.
There's a lot of those films. It's sort of an era where there was only a few composers that you really... It's still the case. Like, you probably hear of one or two composers every year that everyone knows, and then the rest of them just sort of sit in the background and do all of the work for all of the films that you like get Oscar awards and stuff like that, but never get anything for the song. So, he's an unsung hero of cinema.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Interesting that he had an origin like John Barry's as well, with a group that fused pop music with classical music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose the other thing as well is with a lot of composers in the music industry that you sort of need a film or a project like Bond to be recognised, because what you create becomes a very memorable theme. If you're just doing film by film by film, that it never becomes a memorable theme, which is a shame, but way the industry works.
Mm-hmm. So from one License to Kill to another, I think.
Oh, we've got another License to Kill thing.
I think so.
It always happens in the episodes.
Yeah. K is for Crest, Milton Crest. So, yeah, that was literally my link from License to Kill another License to Kill. And so Milton Crest is one of the antagonists of License to Kill, and he's played by an actor called Anthony Zerber. And if you remember, Crest is a drug smuggler who works under the cover of being a marine researcher. And we will cover Anthony Zerber and License to Kill and Milton Crest in a lot more detail when we get to the episode for L is for License to Kill. So, but here are just a few things that you need to know about Milton Crest before we get to that episode. So he's loosely inspired by a character of the same name from Ian Fleming's short story, The Hildebrand Rarity. And I think you'll probably agree that he's best known for having one of the most brilliantly ridiculous and gory deaths in all of James Bond history. Do you remember this one?
Yeah, he gets put in a... It's not micro... Is it microwave?
No, it's a decompression chamber.
Same thing yeah. would happen.
And it explodes.
Sanchez compresses him or decompresses him and his head explodes, yeah. And he's got that brilliant, like, exploding head. A bit like Live and Let Die, actually, thinking about it, isn't it? At the end of that. But Anthony Zerber actually is a busy actor, actually. He made his movie debut in the film Cool Hand Luke. Paul Newman. And he also starred in The Omega Man. I think that's Charlton Heston, isn't it? That's the original I Am Legend film. He appeared in the Molly Maguires. Do you remember that one from the Sean
Absolutely
Connery
no
episode?
No.
That was one of Sean Connery's non-Bond films in the 70s, the Molly Maguires. And he also starred in Papillon as well. I can't remember who's... Is that Paul Newman as well? I can't remember.
Steve McQueen,
that's it, yeah. So after License to Kill, Anthony Zerber appeared in Star Trek Insurrection as Vice Admiral Doherty.
Fantastic.
And he also played Counselor Hammond in The Matrix Reloaded and The Matrix Revolutions. And I'd literally never even connected him with being the same person as Milton Crest.
Well, I can't remember either of those films anyway, so I'm definitely not going to revisit.
There's a scene where Neo is in Zion and he's like on a balcony thing, and he's like looking out over Zion, and this like Zion elder comes up to him, starts talking to him. Anyway, that was Anthony Zerber. So quite an interesting actor, done a lot of stuff, still working. I think it's been a few years since his last major role though, but what do we think of Milton Crest?
He's an awful baddie. He's sort of got this weird realm between sort of comedy. It's like a comedy baddie, but he's not really that funny. He's not in any way menacing. He just seems... there's a lot of characters in that film that don't really... They've got too many characters. They should have like focused on just two good baddies, but they throw a lot more in, and he sort of gets the short straw when it comes to baddies, because he's not really... doesn't really serve any purpose.
He's a slimy creep, isn't he?
Yeah. He's like a video game, isn't it, where he's like just one of the middle bosses that you just have to get out of the way before you get to the big boss at the end. But yeah, that's Milton Crest.
K is for Khan, Kamal Khan. So again, this is a character that we'll talk about in quite a lot of depth when we get to the Octopussy episode. But I'll just a little bit about Kamal Khan. He is the... Well, not... I suppose, is he the main baddie in Octopussy? He's half of the main baddies, isn't he? Because you've also got General Orlov, who is sort of his confusing baddie associate. So Kamal Khan is like this Afghan prince who has a forgery business, and he's working with General Orlov to set up some sort of... I can never remember how this works. He's trying to set off a nuclear bomb in an airbase in West Germany, and he wants to start sort of Holocaust in Western Europe. Octopus is a confusing film.
It is.
I actually tried to read through some plots, and I got lost reading the plots. So I thought, well, I'm going to leave this until we actually do the episode on Octopussy. I'm not going to try and work it all out. But he is, it's a sort of strange character. Octopussy's got a lot of issues with it, especially with the confusing storyline, the intertwining series of plots, the multiple baddies. In many ways, they've probably put him in as a counterpart to Bond, because they're both meant to be these sort of debonair, cool men that like the finer things in life. But he's not really like Bond in any way. There's the weird intertwining story with Octopus herself as well, who he's using as a front for his schemes, his fake jewellery schemes. But yeah, I think as a character, we'll go into more depth of him on when we do the Octopus episode. But he's kind of, I'd say, memorable, but not for any good reason. He's definitely not down as one of the best baddies in a Bond film. He does have quite a memorable death. There's a plane sequence in Octopussy where eventually Roger jumps out of the plane and leaves Kamal Khan to crash into, I think it's the side of a mountain, might be a hill. But interestingly, when I was reading about this, apparently a lot of the scenes from that were used in GoldenEye, or some of the scenes were used in GoldenEye, reused because they weren't actually used in Octopussy. Kamal Khan was played by Louis Jourdain, who is a French actor who was fairly popular in France. He did a lot of films in his early years, and his most notable films that he did outside of French films, because I don't know any of them, are the Paradine Case, which is a Hitchcock film from 1947, and he was also in Gigi. Have either of you seen Gigi?
Nope.
No.
Very, very famous film from the 50s. He was in that, and he had quite a big role. He sort of started getting himself into these leading man roles, debonair leading man roles. But then, of course, he was in Octopussy. His career when he was working in Hollywood after his earlier days in French films wasn't quite as illustrious. They did do quite a few things at the time that were probably seen as quite good, but there's not many that's been remembered in the modern day. He kind of moved into TV a bit more. So he was in episodes of Charlie's Angels and Columbo, episodes of Count Dracula at the time. So, didn't do a lot. And then later on, he started, you might see him, sometimes he's kind of turns up in 70s, 80s films that really aren't very good. So he was in Return of Swamp Thing and the original Swamp Thing, which are not very good films. I remember watching them in the 80s and they're not very good. But his career went a bit off the rails in the 80s as he got a bit older. But he was born in 1921, died in 2015. He didn't really do a lot in the latter part of his career. That is Kamal Khan.
K is for Kincaid.
Now we're talking.
Yes, now we're talking. The character in Skyfall. So he's the gamekeeper at Skyfall Estate from when Bond was a young boy. And he plays a crucial part in where they get to Skyfall and Bond and M need to protect themselves against Silver. So they go to Skyfall for refuge, and Kincaid takes a liking to M as well. For the amount of time that Kincaid's on screen, he makes such a big impression. It's very good. So he enables them to batten down the hatches, board everything up, get the shotgun out, and then guide them through an escape tunnel that gets them to the chapel, which essentially saves, it doesn't save M, sadly, but, and then they get to confront Silver. Yeah, so Silver kills M and dies in Bond's arms. But
spoilers.
In turn, if it's been out 10 years, if you haven't watched it, it's your fault. And you listen to a James Bond podcast. great character, played by Albert Finney. Now, Albert Finney was born 1936, and he went to RADA, and he's a huge British actor that's spanned many decades.
Institution.
Yeah. He's known for Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, Annie, Miller's Crossing, Erin Brockovich, Big Fish, Bourne Ultimatum, Bourne Legacy, and the last film, his final screen role was actually as Kincaid. Barbara Broccoli said, "Albert Finney is the most extraordinary man, sexy, wonderful and delightful. I think he's going to be very well remembered in this role because of the relationship he has with Bond. It goes way back and he appears just in the nick of time. It's delightful to have him in a Bond film because Cubby desperately wanted to work with him. And of course, I've wanted to work with him. but we've never had the opportunity until now. He is a legend, a fantastic actor, and just funny, charming, extraordinary, and dead sexy. Be still my beating heart. Full of praises for Albert Finney. And he himself said, I think it's a terrific film. Sam Mendes has done a really great job. And I think Daniel Craig, the third time he's played the part, really fits the jacket snugly and has a nice edge to him. Which is what we said about Connery and Goldfinger, isn't it? It's pretty much what we said. Just replace the name, Daniel Craig for Sean Connery. The third time, you know, it seems to... That's when they really get going.
Third time's a charm.
Yeah. So Albert Finney declined a CBE in 1980 and a knighthood in 2000, and he said royally bestowed honours are perpetuating snobbery.
Absolute legend.
sadly, he died of a chest infection in 2019. We will cover more on Kincaid when we get to Skyfall, and there's not enough time to go into detail with Albert Finney's career because it's vast and extensive.
He's great. He's great in that. I think in Skyfall he gets a really good chance to act properly because all of his scenes are done in that really nice Scottish setup where there's no distractions. Mm-hmm. You can imagine if you put Albert Finney in a Pierce Brosnan film, he wouldn't have been able to be as good as he is in that film. Mm-hmm. It's like the perfect role for him. It's almost like there's only what three characters acting throughout the whole thing, so it's really a chance for some good acting. So it's a perfect opportunity for him, and that's probably why he's lasted so long as being well remembered in that role.
It's great because
see him in Spectre.
No, it's great because you believe it when it's his domain. It's like they're entering where he's been for years, and it does feel like that. It feels lived in. It feels like he's there. You know, it's
why
it's
is he still there? He's the caretaker,
isn't he? Gamekeeper, isn't he? So,
right, but nobody else lives there.
No,
and nobody else visits there. It's just like a derelict house that he's been told to stay at.
Well, it's his loyalty to the family, isn't it? I guess it speaks volumes about the parents of Bond and the sort of people they were. That they, I guess, that's what they're trying to say.
He's got one shotgun.
Yeah, but he worked with Harry Saltzman, early in his career, hadn't he? Finney. And I think, was he not considered for Bond at one point, perhaps?
I mean, who wasn't at that point? That's the thing. He, you know, started making a career for himself in film in the 60s. So, yes, you would...
Sid James?
Yeah. that film, the Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, I don't know if you've ever seen that, but like an absolute classic of British cinema, well worth seeking out.
Yeah.
Are you going to mention the elephant in the room with Kincaid or...
I thought we'd cover that for Skyfall. Otherwise, we'll just be covering it again, won't we?
Yeah, okay. Well, when you get to Skyfall, there's a lot more interesting information about Kincaid to discuss, I guess.
Yeah, there is. I've got it in front of me, but I thought we'll cover it twice. So
Save it. Save it. We've got a lot to get through today.
Keep the powder dry. Hey, do you guys want to play a game?
Oh, do I?
Yes. Here we go. Right.
I'd say yes now. When we play it, I'll probably say I wish I hadn't played that game. But yeah, let's give it a go.
When I was putting this episode together, I know I was thinking about the letter K, and for some reason that led me to Kevin Bacon. So I thought on some of the people that we cover in this episode that we would play a game of
not a name that normally gets associated with Bond,
but 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. Do you know how that works?
Yeah, but explain for anyone that doesn't.
All right, so basically the theory is that you can get to the actor Kevin Bacon via his co-stars within 6 moves. Any actor, you can get to Kevin Bacon. In fact, I think it's even like any person, you can get to Kevin Bacon. So basically you've got to try and find the link between...
Any person?
Well,
what,
maybe
like
that's pushing it.
My auntie?
Yeah. No, but let's just say actors. Anyway... You've got to name the film, their co-star, and then their co-star, what they've starred in, and then, you know, link it back to Kevin Bacon. Yes. Does that even make sense?
Yes. When we were at uni, I think we played it. We didn't have to play it with Kevin Bacon. You could play it with other people as well, which made it a little bit more interesting. I don't know why Kevin Bacon somehow won this.
Yeah, he's become the guy, hasn't he?
Surely there's going to come a point soon where people are like, who is Kevin Bacon? And they can it'll be someone new. It'll be like 6 degrees of...
James Corden.
I mean, not with the amount of EE adverts that Kevin Bacon does. I think everyone's still going to be aware of him.
Yeah, but you can't link to him through EE adverts.
No, you can't.
let's cut to the chase. Right, okay. Let's try and get to Albert Finney. From Albert Finney to Kevin Bacon. Who's going to put their bid in? for the least amount of moves.
I'm trying to remember what the moves are.
I've got
four. Three, four.
I've got two.
I've got two as well.
Yeah.
What's yours, Wheatley?
Oh, no, hold on. No, I think I might have a two as well.
Yeah, I've got two,
because I've got this one film that I always use. You just basically, when you play 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon, you just have to have, there's like five films that you can use that always give you really easy options.
Go on then,
what's yours? I've got two, yeah.
Go on, say it then.
So, Kevin Bacon was in Flatliners.
Yes.
I use Flatliners.
Yes.
This is one of those films. You've got Flatliners, you've got Outsiders. If you can get someone through there, you're sorted. And then with Julia Roberts and then Erin Brockovich.
Albert Finney was in Erin Brockovich with Julia Roberts. That's what I had as well. What about you, Brendan?
Kevin Bacon was in Black Mass.
Oh, go on. Mm.
With Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
Who was in Corpse Bride.
With Albert Finney. Very good.
That's good. I would not have known that. Yeah.
Well, that was fun. Should we do it again?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. We'll keep our powder dry, though, for a bit longer. Let's move on. Okay. K is for Kleinman, Daniel Kleinman. So you will know who Daniel Kleinman is. He is the British filmmaker who has created the title sequences for every James Bond film since GoldenEye up to No Time to Die, apart from Quantum of Solace. So, taking it right back again to License to Kill, did you know that Daniel Kleinman's first brush with James Bond came through License to Kill because he directed the music video for Gladys Knight's License to Kill in 1989? Before we get to that, then, let's have a quick look back at Daniel Kleinman's life. So, he was born on 23rd of December 1955 in London. While he was at school, he was in a band called Bazooka Joe, which turned out to be quite an important, well, not important, but just an interesting, they hold an interesting place in music history. The lineup at various times included Adam Ant from Adam and the Ants and also Arabella Weir. And they were the headliners when the Sex Pistols played their first ever live show. So it's a fun little link to Daniel Kleinman for you. So he's part of a creative agency called Rattling Stick now. And so according to his bio on the Rattling Stick website, Kleinman attended Hornsey Art School and then went on to work as an illustrator, collaborating on storyboards with directors and that working on the sort of music video industry, which was burgeoning at that point in the early 80s. And in his first music video that he worked on or directed was in 1983, Crushed by the Wheels of Industry by Heaven 17. That's according to his official bio on Rattling Stick. But according to IMDb, he actually worked on Adam and the Ant's Ant music video in 1980 before that. So I'm not sure what to believe on those, but both of them very big, important videos. In the 80s, he directed more than 100 music videos for acts, including Madonna, Van Halen, Simple Minds, Prince, Fleetwood Mac and ZZ Top. And then in the 1990s, he moved into directing adverts and commercials for clients, which include Guinness, Xbox, Chrysler, Johnny Walker, Sony, Audi, Boddington's, John Smith's, Super Noodles, Durex and John West. And he's... His style, he became known in the commercials world for being someone who was a pioneer with visual effects and CGI. And one of his most famous adverts was that Galaxy advert with the CGI Audrey Hepburn. I don't know if you remember that.
Hated it. Yeah, really annoying.
He's also really well known for, or according to his bio, his best known work is an advert called Know It to Love, which was for Guinness, which is the word evolution spelled backwards. And I don't know if you remember this advert, but it was kind of brilliant. It was three or four guys in a pub. They drink take a sip of Guinness, and then they regress into cavemen, and then they regress into monkeys, and then they regress into like sea creatures.
When I was working for an advertising agency around that time, when was this?
Oh, 2000 and something, 2006,
yeah,
I think.
I was working with an advertising agency and they used that for every pitch. It's like the best way to do advertising, the best advert out at the moment.
Yeah.
Guinness always did that though. They always had...
They had such amazing adverts, yeah.
Yeah.
And so that one, you know, it took them all right back to the beginning of time, and then it was good things come to those who wait. You know, it was going to take millions of years to evolve to get Guinness. But yeah, anyway, that won a prize at the Cannes Film
Grand Prix. That's the advertising Cannes, not the actual Cannes Film Festival. He also, other adverts he worked on, the M&S Christmas advert with Paddington Bear. Do you remember that one where he discovered Santa on the roof, but it was just a burglar?
No.
No, I don't remember that
was only that was only a couple of years ago. The John West advert where there was a bear fighting a fisherman for the fish. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, remember that one. Yeah,
that was a good one.
Another John West advert.
And in 1994, he directed the TV movie Smashy and Nicey, The End of an Era, which is obviously a Harry Enfield.
Interesting you should bring up Harry Hill, because I'm going to mention him later on. Very strange. I didn't even know there was a TV episode about that. I watched that.
Yeah, it sounds quite good. Smashy and Nicey, and it cuts like to the beginning of their career, and there's loads of celebrities in it as well. Sounds really good. Right, on to Bond. After Maurice Binder died in 1991, Michael G. Wilson and Barbara Broccoli were looking for someone to take over. They had been particularly impressed with the video that had been done for License to Kill's music video, and if you watch it now, it is brilliant. It's got Gladys Knight in a suit. But then behind her, there's like loads of like Bond type visuals. It's really, really well done. So he was brought in to work on GoldenEye, which is something we covered very recently. So see previous episode for what he did on that. But that was his very first ever title sequence. And actually, although we know him as the Bond title director, he only makes titles for James Bond film. He doesn't do them for any other films, only for the James Bond films, which I thought was quite interesting. Mm. So in an interview with Art of the Titles, Daniel Kleinman said, "I remember Michael asking me, 'Do you think we should keep the girls? Should we have guns in it?' There'd been some question, now that Morris had died, whether the style should carry on or whether it should change. And my answer was that we should keep all the visual tropes that Morris had set up and kind of update it. And that was the answer they wanted to hear, so I did get the job." I think we covered a bit of that when we did GoldenEye. Mm. He is a Bond fan. He says that Goldfinger was his very first James Bond film. Obviously, you remember GoldenEye, that covers like the fall of the Soviet Union, and it's just a fantastic title sequence. He updated the gun barrel at that time as well, using CGI for the first time. And interestingly, someone called Eddie Kidd doubles for Brosnan in the titles of GoldenEye. I don't know if you knew that, but good on this episode for Kafer.
Did he do Die Another Day titles?
Yes, he did, yeah.
Right, okay.
Idea.
So
got a bit trigger happy with the CGI then, didn't he?
So the CGI in that time, 1995, you know, really was a fledgling industry, and he said it was a really painful process to put those titles together for GoldenEye. He said the sequence was edited in an analog edit suite first, then copied by eye on a high-resolution digital film compositing machine, which at the time was very, very slow, and a cumbersome way of creating optical effects. Then he did Tomorrow Never Dies, which we'll cover in another episode, and that's the one where it's everything's like X-ray and you can see like, through things and all that sort of stuff. The World Is Not Enough has the oil theme because of the film, the oil pipelines of the film.
Yeah.
And so it's got all that iridescent stuff going on. And then Die Another Day, obviously, we covered recently. That's all the scorpions and the torture and all that sort of stuff. So talking about doing Casino Royale, he said, "At the time I did Casino Royale, the technology had caught up and I was able to work in a more spontaneous and flexible way. So I think I started enjoying the process more. I certainly enjoyed the creative part of GoldenEye, Casino Royale and Skyfall, as I feel they were closest to what I had in my mind." So we covered his titles for Casino Royale on that episode, so you can listen back to that. He missed out on Quantum of Solace because Mark Forster wanted to bring in his own team, and he brought in these guys called MK12. We'll cover that again on Quantum of Solace. But he was full of praise for them. He said that he thought they did a great job. So there's no bad blood there. He did Skyfall, which has Bond's death. So it's this sort of life flashing before your eyes type thing in that one. And we'll cover that when we get to Skyfall. And then he did Spectre. And then No Time to Die. And he also shot the music video for Billie Eilish's No Time to Die song. So we'll cover No Time to Die in more depth when we get there. So he was asked what the sequence is to making a classic Bond title sequence. And he says there are a lot of things to put in the main titles to ensure it's jam-packed with stuff. And you have to be able to enjoy it initially without knowing all these references on the first viewing. But I think diehard fans will enjoy some of those references. I'm sure there will be people who will miss them the first time, but will get them eventually. And I think that's true, especially with No Time to Die. Having seen that film a few times, there's stuff I didn't notice in the first time I saw those titles that totally make sense now, but don't on the first watch. And actually, the 007 website put up a big in-depth interview with Daniel Kleinman talking about the No Time to Die title. So I would recommend seeking that out. It's called Roll the Titles. So like I said, he doesn't shoot them for anyone else. He said, I've never really taken a great deal of notice of title sequences. I didn't set out to do them, and I don't do any other than Bond, which I do for fun. I'm really an advertising director and therefore shoot a lot of disparate types of things. I suppose I don't think of myself as a title sequence director, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know that about him. I just assumed he did lots of different ones. And it was only when I looked at his IMDb that it sort of came clear that he doesn't. So, yeah, that's Daniel Kleinman, which I think, you know, I think he's a worthy successor to Maurice Binder, if you ask me.
Yeah, he definitely moved it on into a digital age, didn't he?
Yeah.
Few hiccups, but Maurice Binder had hiccups as well along the way. So he definitely, I think the fact that if he'd just done Brosnan era stuff, he wouldn't have been so sort of well remembered for what he'd done. But because he'd moved into the Craig era, he did some fantastic stuff in there, and you can really see the development of his skills over that period.
Yeah, I think one thing I would say is I think I like Casino Royale's titles the best.
I think it's excellent. Yeah,
yeah.
It was something different, but it was in the style of a Bond title, but it was
just very, it was simple, but interesting. And I think that's the key to doing titles well, because if you've got the technology to do it, because at that time, like those titles, they're not like, people weren't watching it going, these titles are groundbreaking. They were just great. Like, it wasn't like he was trying to throw in CGI to make it look amazing. He didn't need to. He just made it good, and that's the key to it. Once you start making these titles and Die Another Day, throwing in CGI that, you know, okay, you can do it, but you don't need to do it. It's unnecessary. By Casino Royale, he kind of got to the point where I think he was confident with what he was doing, and he just knew how to do it well to create a great title sequence.
The Casino Royale one's got a touch of Saul Bass about it as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's just ticks so many boxes. It's sort of like retrospective, but it's modern, but it's smart. It really ties in nicely with the story. It's just a really, I imagine he uses that as his main sort of, you know, show reel, just because it just ticks all the boxes perfectly. Yeah. Whereas, you know, look at some of the other ones, and you can look at bits in Tomorrow Never Dies and go, oh, that looks quite nice. But, you know, we all remember the Casino Royale title sequence and fondly. We don't necessarily remember the other ones.
The other thing we need to remember is he's got a song that he's got to work with, and he's got a very dynamic, different song with the Casino Royale.
That's true, yeah.
Poor Kleinman trying to do Madonna's song. What is this? Oh, she just sent it to us.
He often gets the script, and he says he starts to work on it from the script. And so there are occasions where he's come up with an idea and they've just completely gone in a different direction. I think Skyfall one went through quite a few different iterations, I think.
I can imagine when you get a script, if you work on that principle, you get the Casino Royale script, you just go, oh, thank goodness. Right, I can really do something good. You get a Die Another Day script, and you're like, I don't know what to do here. Can anybody help me? No? Okay. Scorpions.
Maybe the music will bring me inspiration. I don't know. What's this?
Nothing. Got nothing. Okay, K is for King, Electra King. I'm not going to go into too much depth with Electra King, not only because we're going to cover the character when we get through to The World's Not Enough, but also because I don't really want to go into too much depth with Electra King. She holds quite an interesting place in the Bond history, because at the time where she appeared in the film, it was an interesting time for female characters in the Bond series. Bear in mind, this is the point where Barbara Broccoli had been at the helm for a couple of years, but after GoldenEye, she'd already started planning ahead. So she was already putting together plans for The World Is Not Enough, and also putting together plans for how she wanted to work with the teams for the future Bond films. So Electra King is an interesting character in the Bond series, in that she sort of shifts the story and the characters of females that are within the Bond films and turns them into more rounded characters. So Electra King, throughout the story of The World Is Not Enough. She starts off as the victim of the story. So she is the daughter of Sir Robert King, who is blown up at MI5, and Bond starts investigating this bombing. And yes, as I say, she was the victim. But over the course of the film, you find out that Reynard, the main villain in The World Is Not Enough, is actually in cahoots with Electra King. And not only in cahoots, but Electra King is actually the main baddie of The World Is Not Enough.
Spoilers?
Well, to be honest, one, I don't think you can spoil The World Is Not Enough. And two, yeah, if you're watching, if you're listening to this and thinking, ooh, never heard of that film, might watch that, good luck to you. So, Electra King, I think she's a very interesting character. She's very, there's a lot of elements to her character that have never been really addressed in a Bond film. Maybe they've tried to in the past, but it wasn't until this point where they really sort of opened up the whole idea of a female character that had all these different dimensions and was the baddie of the whole thing, really, at the top level. She probably paved the way for a lot of the characterization that happens later in the Daniel Craig era, when female characters become a lot more prominent and basically get as good as the roles as the male counterparts get. But she, so Electra King was played by Sophie Marceau. Sophie Marceau is a French actor. And again, there's a lot of French films that Sophie Marceau acted in throughout her career. It wasn't until later on that she started working in films in the US and the UK. The real turning point, I think, for Sophie Marceau was Braveheart. So she plays the main one of the main characters in Braveheart. I'm trying to remember Braveheart, so I didn't actually research Braveheart when I was going through this. But doesn't he have already have a wife, and then he sort of falls in love with the French queen, which I think she plays.
I think so.
Yeah, I remember her from that film, but it's about 4 hours long, isn't that film? And I was about 13, so I didn't really pay attention to it. I saw it at the cinema, didn't get home until about 1 a.m. She was also in Anna Karenina, which I haven't seen. And then there's a Midsummer Night's Dream. And then she was in The World Is Not Enough. She later on, there's not really anything that she's been in later after The World Is Not Enough that I know of, really. So she's still acting up to today, but there's not really a lot. She's kind of moved back to a lot of French films after that. But yeah, she never really reached the heights that she did in The World Is Not Enough. But as I say, we'll go into more depth with Sophie Marceau and Electra King when we get around to The World Is Not Enough episode. What do you think to her? Good character?
Yeah, I think they sort of... I think they could have made more of her being the proper main villain. I think she has a great ending, let's put it that way.
Is this, I think if you'd done The World Is Not Enough in 2022, she would have been very good, and they would have really created a fantastic, rounded character for her. I think at that point in cinema and in script writing, they tried, but it was still, the script was very skewed towards Bond and, him being in charge of that thing. So there's a lot of subtext to it, like the whole
Stockholm syndrome.
So they mentioned that or they suggest it in the film, and it's done in a very 90s way. In like, it's very obvious, very simple. I don't think, like, nowadays I think it'd be a lot more complex and it'd be more interesting. So I think the concept was right, but I think the time wasn't quite right, and they couldn't really do the character and the storyline justice based on the sort of gender focus that they had at the time. But yeah, she's definitely an important part of the Bond series, but still, could have been better.
When I think of Electra King, I don't think of the character. I think of what she does to Bond in that chair when she's tightening the thing, and Brosnan's face when he's that's all I think of.
Yeah.
She's the son of Marcel Marceau, isn't she? The famous mine.
Is she?
Yeah,
I don't know much about Marceau.
Not the son, the daughter.
Let's
clear that up. Yeah, she's the daughter of Marcel Marceau, I think, the famous mime. So
that's okay. So Marcel Marceau, I find quite funny, because I everybody of our era and age knows the name, but I don't think anybody really knows anything about Marceau Marceau. Like, if you had to say, what did he actually do? You'd be like, mime? Which doesn't really answer why he's so famous and well known. But yeah, I'm not going to say I'm going to go into depth about Marceau Marceau in the...
Stop saying Marcel Marceau.
Well, I just want to, you know, Marceau Marceau.
Say cahoots again. I prefer it when you're saying cahoots.
Do I not say cahoots very often? I think I'll start putting that in more.
I'd like to say, I like,
I'm sure
I like
there's some cahoots going on in Craig's films. Did I say cahoots twice in this?
Yeah. Yes.
I'm just trying to think who else we've got coming up that I could say cahoots in. I'll have a think.
K is for cahoots.
It's a C, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. But
all right, okay. So don't. Yeah, that's, we should have done that earlier.
But
all right, there we go. There's that's Marceau Marceau's daughter, Sophie Marceau, playing Electric King.
K is for Kleb, Rosa Kleb. And
now we're cooking on gas.
Well, we've already cooked on gas, haven't we? Because we've already covered her
very recently. So, yeah,
very recently. She is Spectre number 3 in the film From Rush with Love. She has a scheme that the scheme is to basically kill 007 in the end by setting up a honey trap. Go back to From Rush with Love to find out all about that film. It ends in a character. Character's demise is really famous with the poison tip shoes, where she's dressed as a chambermaid in Venice. So, played by Lotta Lenya, who was actually born Caroline with a K, so that's good, we're okay, we're safe. Caroline Wilhelmine Charlotte Blaumauer in 1898, and she was an Austrian American singer and actress, mostly famous in the German speaking world for being a singer. And singing with her first husband, Kurt Weill. So much so that Louis Armstrong actually, when he recorded the song Mac the Knife, both he did a solo version and a duet with Lotta Lenya, he added her name to the lyrics. And it's stuck ever since, because when Bobby Darin recorded it, it also stuck. And I went and checked and saw if Robbie Williams' version, and he did, he kept it in there as well. So, yeah. Her name is in that song. So yeah, she didn't do many films. In terms of films, English speaking films, this was it really. She died in 1981, but in the singing world, she's like huge. She's got so much respect and for that sort of era. But that's Lotta Lenya. What do you think about Lotta Lenya's performance? We've talked about this before, but I mean, she's
really fantastic.
She's excellent.
Yeah. Really fantastic. Layered character. There's a lot of elements to it. She's like, she's like a Bond villain done well, because she serves multiple purposes. She's meant to be a scary character in her own sense, but she's also very scared of Blofeld, and you can see that in her. And she manages to be both menacing to Bond. Mm-hmm. But also be kind of very scared of Blofeld, which really adds this really clever level of tension between Bond and Blofeld throughout the episode.
Yeah,
she's fantastic, and she's also just so memorable as well.
Yeah,
well, I think people who don't even know Bond know Kleb.
The shoes help as well, but it's like something we keep talking about. This sort of be someone who stands out from the crowd. She's a villain. She's physically unique. You know, she's a small, petite person. She's got a memorable face. Yeah. And that introduction where she punches Red Granite in the stomach with the knuckle dusters just tells you everything you need to know, doesn't it? She's, like, not scared of anything. She carries
apart
knuckle
from
dusters.
Blofeld.
Well, apart from Blofeld, yeah. But, yeah, just terrific. And to think that she's not really an actor as well. Like, that's an amazing piece of casting.
It is, yeah.
To come up with that from her, like, even she, I think, said at the time, like, I don't know why they've cast me.
She always reminds me of, around that period, there was this sort of older lady character that was quite prominent in movies. And even in Psycho, like his mother in Psycho, always reminds me of, like, she could have been his mother in Psycho. She's got that sort of menacing, dangerous quality that you don't quite understand throughout it. And it popped up in films quite a lot around that era. She really did sort of, her and, there was no woman in Psycho, but that sort of character was very good. And she, Rosa Clare probably sits at the top of that pile as that sort of menacing, middle-aged woman that is just scary.
Yeah. You know, she reminds me of, now you said that, it's the Mama Fratelli in the Goonies.
Yeah, same sort of thing, yeah.
And then also the woman in Superman 3, the villain in that, you know, that gets turned into a robot.
No, I've got no idea. we're talking about classic films here, and you're throwing in Superman 3. I think, don't even, what happens in Superman 3?
Superman 3 is one with Richard Pryor in it. I absolutely love that. It's probably one of my... I think it might
that
even...
Is, that isn't... Yeah,
my favourite Superman film. Yeah. I used to watch that so often. Anyway, that was a bit of a tangent.
Yeah. That's what it's all about, tangents. Because it means I can do less research.
And talking of someone we've just recently covered, Christassos. Case now for Christassos, we're talking. Aristotle Christassos. Played, obviously, by Julian Glover in 1981's For Your Eyes Only. See previous episode for more details on Christassos. But in summary, you know, he's hired by the KGB to track down the ATAC. And he is also inspired by a short story from the Ian Fleming... inspired by a character from the Ian Fleming short story, Risiko. But Christassos aside, we can't gloss over Julian Glover, because Julian Glover is a complete screen legend. So just in summary, he was born in 1935 and he's a classically trained actor who studied at RADA. His credits include, are you ready? Mm-hmm. Doctor Who, The Avengers, The Saint, Blake 7, Quatermass and the Pit, Star Wars, Walter Donovan as Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Casualty. He was in Harry Potter. He played Aragog. He's Grandmaster Pycelle in Game of Thrones. He was in Merlin. He's in The Crown. He's even in Inside Number 9. He just an amazing, amazing career this man has had.
Yeah, I mean, you could have missed out some of them. I don't think.
But just to give you the breadth,
his amazing work in Last Crusade and Casualty will not be forgotten.
Well, he's been in Casualty a couple of times and Holby City, or playing different characters each time. But
he must be good if he's in Holby City and Casualty.
Shows his range.
There you go. he was different
surgeries.
He was appointed a commander of the Order of the British Empire in 2013. And did you know he actually screen tested to play James Bond for Live and Let Die?
He said, surprised me in the slightest.
In an interview with Bond Locations, he said, I was one of several people who were tested for James Bond. I think there are six of us. I didn't do a very good test, I'm afraid, and I didn't get the part. That was the end of that. At the time, all six of us knew it had to be Roger. When he was sitting there and waiting, he was a living, breathing James Bond. And indeed, we were right. I'm really glad that he got the part, because he was a brilliant Bond, and obviously he would go on to play opposite Roger
as
Bond.
But if you think about that, obviously, like, Glover wouldn't be right for the Roger Moore era, but Glover's a very Timothy Dalton actor. Mm. He could easily have fit into the Timothy Dalton mold.
Yeah. And every time, like we say, you know, there's always... talk of, you know, it always seems it was obviously going to be Roger, or obviously going to be Pierce Brosnan or whatever. But they're always testing other people. They really do their homework to make sure they get the right person.
Yeah.
So just talking about working on For Your Eyes Only, Julian Glover said, that was wonderful. That was such a good time. Before that, I'd had a terrible period out of work, 6 months in all, and I was in despair and I had to sell the house. I thought the chances of me getting the Bond film were slim, but they gave me the part and I was cast as the main villain. When I got to Corfu, I was handed a thick brown envelope with money in it. I hadn't seen any proper money for 2 years. It was simply fantastic. And then on top of all that, I was working with Roger Moore, who was such a witty man.
Absolutely lovely.
He tells a story about Roger pranking him during the restaurant scene. Basically, they were recording right into the night. It was a night shoot. They were just kept doing the same scene over and over again. Roger got his wife onto set, put a fake mustache on her, and then during a scene while they were shooting, she tipped prawns down all down the front of Julian Glover, and Julian Glover obviously looked up like, what the hell is going on? And it was Roger's wife dressed up, and apparently it really just set the tone for the rest of the night, and they're all just happy to carry on working through the night. So I know we're not talking about Roger Moore here, but I mean, this whole podcast is about Roger Moore, isn't it?
I don't think anybody listening to this is going to be annoyed that you've mentioned Roger.
Right, should we play Kevin Bacon with Julian Glover?
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah.
Who wants to go first?
Well, I think I've got three.
I've got two.
I've got three as well, so...
Oh, actually, no, mine's a three, isn't it? Yeah, mine's
a three.
Oh,
here we go.
Here we go.
I bet we've all got the same one. Go on.
Yeah, probably. Well, Brendan,
you go first.
This is like... There's certain films that have lots of people in. Obviously, the easiest way is going to be Last Crusade.
Yes.
So, starting on Last Crusade and then going to Untouchables.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, you got Robert De Niro in Untouchables.
Yeah.
Then Sleepers.
Yeah.
With, obviously, Kevin Bacon.
Very good. What about you, Brendan?
Julian Glover was in The Fourth Protocol with Michael Caine.
Yeah.
Who was in Interstellar with John Lithgow.
Yeah.
Who was in Footloose with Kevin Bacon. I've got Around the Houses on that one.
Oh, I've got a good one then. I've got a different one. So Julian Glover was in Last Crusade with Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford was in Raiders of the Lost Ark with Karen Allen. And Karen Allen was in Animal House, which features Kevin Bacon in one of his very first roles.
Mm. Jesus Christ, I would not have got that. You did not know that. You did not work that out for yourself.
I did.
You did a bit of research to get that.
I did.
You knew Animal House had those characters in it?
Yeah.
Impressive.
It's one of his favourite films.
He's never mentioned it in his life.
There is. You can actually get it in two, though. Did you know? Because he's also in the film Mirrors in 2008 with Kiefer Sutherland, who was in Flatliners.
Flatliners is a go-to, isn't it?
Yeah. So that's the quickest one, I think. But yes, let's move on.
K is for Kwok, Burt Kwok. Now, Burt Kwok is a very, very interesting Bond alumni because he's famous. He's sort of, at the time, he wasn't really famous for being in Bond. And in modern day times, he's not really famous for being in Bond, but and the role that he has in Bond is sort of quite minor, really. And you only really if he was only in one Bond film, you probably wouldn't talk about it. But because he was in two, it actually becomes a little bit more interesting. So Burt Kwok, he was in Goldfinger and You Only Live Twice. And he didn't play big roles in those films. He played sort of secondary, almost sort of semi-extra roles in those films. As I can't try and remember what he was in both of those films. I've written it down here somewhere. He's in Goldfinger. He is working in. He's just like one of his guards. And then You Only Live Twice. I think he's working in the sort of labs as well. He does have speaking parts, but it doesn't say a lot. He says like a few lines, but he sits in that Bond alumni because he's been in more than one Bond film as a different character, and that's it really for Bond. I mean, it's not like he's a massive character. I can't go into depth about the roles that he was playing because he didn't really do a lot, but because he was in those films at that point in time, he's got this weird sort of early pedigree for Bond, really. He's well remembered, and whenever we watch one of his films, we always shout Burt Kwok when he pops up, because he is great in them. He's just a fantastic character. But he's famous for a lot more than the Bond stuff that he did. He died in 2016, and his earlier career was really quite interesting. I've not mentioned the third. He was in Casino Royale as well, the 1967.
I was going to say, I'm sure there was a third one.
Yeah, I think he plays like a general in that that film.
He's in the scene where there's a bunch of soldiers in a room. I can't even remember where. Yeah. That film's ridiculous, but they all start rushing out of a room, and he's in there. I can't.
But it's sort of the sign of the times is when he talks about this as well, and I've got a couple of quotes later about it, where when they were looking for an Asian character, he was just a go-to. So when he was in multiple films, because they were just like, oh, let's get Burke Walk in again, because he'll do it, he's good. But his career is actually quite impressive, a lot of the stuff he worked in. He moved around quite a lot. He was born in Warrington in Lancashire, but only because his parents were on a business trip in Europe. He was actually brought up in Shanghai. His father was a textile tycoon as part of the Tang Dynasty lineage. And yeah, he went to a school called the Jesuit Mission School, which was apparently the Far East's equivalent of Eton. In 1947, his Chinese parents went back to Britain, and he was sent to the United States to carry on his education. He graduated from college in Maine, and there was a big fortune behind the family as well. But during the 1949 revolution, all the money was lost. So all of this money that his family had, that he was going to acquire, was gone. So he went back to Britain to start acting. And he made his film debut in a film called Wyndham's Way in 1957. But one of the big films that he did was called The Inn of Sixth Happiness in 1958. And in that film, he starred with Ingrid Bergman. So it's quite a highly revered film at the time. Ingrid Bergman at the time was like, you know, the best of the best, really. And he plays this character who is leading a prison revolt alongside Ingrid Bergman. And it's like an award-winning performance. It's fantastic how he plays this role. It's really it's a really good role for him. And that's sort of how he started becoming famous. So the other thing that he's really famous for, possibly more so than Bond, in fact definitely more so than Bond, is playing Kato Fong in the Inspector Clouseau films, so the Pink Panther films. And if you're a listener to this who's about the same age as us or older, you will remember the Inspector Clouseau films. And there was a lot of them. I think, I can't remember how many, I think it's like seven Pink Panther films. Burke Kwok plays Kato, who works for Inspector Clouseau, as sort of this weird butler guy who is most famous for basically fighting Inspector Clouseau randomly.
There's that one where he jumps out of the fridge and attacks him.
So essentially, Inspector Clouseau has charged Kato, his butler, with the task of always trying to surprise him and like beat him in a fight. And that's how Inspector Clouseau trains. So he pops out and he has a fight with him. And there's this sort of running joke at the end of it, where at the end of the fight sequence, he always has to answer the phone. First plays it in a shot in the dark, and he does it six occasions across the whole of the series. So he plays Kato in a lot of the films in there. I always was surprised how many Pink Panther films there are, because the knowledge that there's that many Pink Panther films really hasn't passed on to present day. I sometimes think back and go, there must be two or three. But yeah, there's quite a lot of them. So yeah, as well as the Pink Panther films, he also starred in a lot of TV stuff as well. He was in the sort of stalwart things that we talk about. So things like Danger Man he was in. So he starred in the fiendish plot of Doctor Who Manchu with Peter Sellers, who references the fact that he's in the Pink Panther films, because he says to him, your face is familiar. So it sort of references the fact that he already knows him from all those films. And they're almost like a double act in a way in that era, that you associate Peter Sellers with him in so many films that he's been in. He was in lots of sort of films, not as famous as the ones that I've talked about. He's starred in quite a lot over his career. And as I said, he was sort of the go-to guy when it came to hiring Asian actors. But one thing that he's extremely famous for, and possibly one of the reasons why people see him in a Bond film and go, that's Burke Kwok, is because of Harry Hill. And I told you I was going to mention Harry Hill when you talked about him earlier. So in the Harry Hill show, he plays this ongoing character. He plays himself, but in comedy scenes. So he just turns up and, you know, if anybody's listening to this who knows Harry Hill, it's ridiculous. He just turn up and he'll just be like some old woman or something like that. And Harry Hill will just call, hey, it's Burke Kwok. He comes in. And as well as that, he also did voiceovers for Banzai. And because of that, then did a lot of betting adverts for Bets 365. I sort of remember those. Do you remember them?
No, but yeah, I remember Banzai, and that is mad. That show.
Yeah, he just got picked up for all these things.
Was that the Mr. Shaky Hands man?
Yeah.
He was also in Last Summer Wine as a character called Electrical Entwistle.
There you go, your favourite.
It's not my favourite.
What, season 32 is that?
I hold it close. It's something I hold close to my heart.
I feel sorry for my... sorry, American and Canadian and Australian listeners. There's probably a lot of references here that aren't going to make any sense.
Just look up... Well, I'd say look up Harry Hill, but it's just going to confuse you. So as well as those things, you've got all the Pink Panther films. He was also in Rollerball as a Japanese doctor in 1975. He was in Empire of the Sun. He was in Air America. He was in Carry On Columbus. He was also in Fat Slags, playing the Dalai Lama. Anyone listening to this who hasn't seen the Fat Slags, don't watch it. On TV, he was in Hancock's Half Hour, The Avengers, The Champions, It Ain't Half Hot Mun, The Tomorrow People, Monkey Magic, Minder, Doctor Who, Hammer House of Mystery and Suspense, The House of Elliot, Lovejoy, and Space Precinct.
So, puts Julian Glover to shame.
Yeah, we should be the game, the Burt Kwok game, rather than the Kevin Bacon game.
6 degrees of Burt Kwok.
Yeah,
I think nobody'd know anything though, because it's quite hard to go through Lovejoy, Space Precinct, and The Tomorrow People to get to anyone.
I can't believe you've mentioned Air America. I feel like we've mentioned Air America about 15 times on this podcast so far.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever watched it. So talking a bit about Burt Kwok, the best person to get quotes from about Burt Kwok is Harry Hill, because he actually talks about Burt Kwok quite a lot and he had a very close relationship. So Burt Kwok died in 2016 and Harry Hill was actually, he was asked to sort of do a memorial thing for him. He talks about, I've got a few quotes from Harry Hill, and they're all quite nice really, because you can kind of see that Harry Hill got him involved just because he really just liked working with him. He says, I went to see him for the last time, that he finally gave me the closest to an opinion on what Peter Sellers was really like. Simply, some days I liked him, some days I didn't like him, which probably tells you all you need to know. He talks about him being a man of few words, but they're always very well-chosen words, and you really had to draw stuff out of him to get a good anecdote from him. Apparently he was a massive smoker as well. Says that though his films were his first love, smoking was his second, and he smoked up till the end. The person who did the costumes on the Harry Hill show used to sew secret pockets into the costumes so he could put cigarettes in his lighter in there.
Oh my god.
And apparently his GP used to bring him 200 duty free back when he went on holiday, even though he told him to stop smoking. He asked him about the martial arts that he knew for the role of Kato in the Pink Panther, and he said, I don't know any martial arts, I always just made it up. And then he talks about playing Japanese commandants and soldiers and Chinese soldiers and even Koreans. He said, you know, Harry, I sometimes wonder if the Second World War was fought just to keep me in work. And then in an interview in 2001, he talks a little bit about the Bond movies. And he says, Bond movies are always great fun because everything about them is big, expensive and huge. The sets are big, the amount of money that's spent is huge, and the whole thing has a big atmosphere about it. And actors like doing that sort of thing. He talks a little bit about how there's an interview online, actually, on YouTube, where they sort of say, oh, do you like getting all the media attention? He's like, you know, you're an actor. Any actor who says they don't like getting the attention and moans about it, why are they an actor? Like, actors want attention. So he's quite honest about all of that sort of stuff. Yeah, so, yeah, that's Burt Kwok. He's amazing man and well remembered, but perhaps not for the right reasons. Yeah, an illustrious career. And he always, I haven't got the quote here, but Harry Hill was talking to him about all of the stuff that he got him to do in the Harry Hill show. And he said that Burt Kwok just didn't get it. He'd like to say to him, like, it's just not funny. I just don't get it. But he'd do it. And Harry Hill always found it funny that he'd just do it and carry on with it. And he was always really good at it. He always thought he was like really involved in it and always like engaged. Just because he was, you know, a professional and he just did what he was told. But at the end of the day, Harry was like, yeah, I don't know. It's not funny. Don't get it at all. I don't know why I'm doing this. Didn't know who all the characters were that he was playing. But yeah, amazing man. And if you ever see a Bond film with him in, give him a cheer.
Yeah, definitely. I think we might have to do the Kwok cast after this. I'm definitely into delving into his career.
Well, I'll do one on Last of Summer Wine.
Yeah.
K is for Koskov, General Georgi Koskov. He is in the living daylights, and he comes up with a scheme with the arms dealer Brad Whitaker to take over the KGB. We're going to cover this. We'll cover the storyline and plot of Living Daylights when we get to it. So he tells the British Secret Service that he wants to defect, basically. And then he asks James Bond to protect him from a KGB sniper who's been assigned to watch him. But in reality, Koskov, his defection is part of this plan to convince MI6 to assassinate Pushkin, who's the head of the KGB. So yeah, you get towards the end, and then, you know, Bond figures it all out, and he puts him in a bag and ships him off, doesn't he?
He puts him in a diplomatic pipeline, doesn't he? Yeah.
Diplomatic pipeline, yeah. And that's where we go off to get executed. But yeah, we'll cover him in the Living Daylights. But he's played by, all right, it's a Dutch actor, so the pronunciation I apologise for, Jeroen Art Krabbe, who was born in 1944. He's been in quite a few films. He's a director and actor. In terms of Bond, he said, "Bond is like a gold stamp in my passport as an actor. The only gold stamp in it. Not that it's been one of the most special productions. I've played in films that were more close to my heart and made films myself. But I think back on it with such fondness." But yeah, so we're not doing Kevin Bacon on Koskov, are we? On Jeroen Krabbe?
No.
I think it'd be pretty hard, to be honest.
Yeah. So, our final instalment, K is for Kananga, Dr. Kananga, a.k.a. Mr. Big, played by Yaphet Kotto in Live and Let Die. So another K there, Yaphet Kotto. He is obviously the villain in that film. Kotto himself was born in November 15th, 1939, and raised by his maternal grandparents. And he studied acting at the Actors Mobile Theatre Studio, and he basically started his acting career on Broadway. So, stage star. He is best known beyond Bond for starring in the NBC series Homicide: Life on the Streets, which he was in from 1993 to 1999, and he played Lieutenant Al Giardello. He's also well known for appearing in Alien, obviously a very memorable appearance in that film. He's there when the chest burster first comes out, William Hurt's chest. And he was also in The Running Man with Arnold Schwarzenegger in 1987. He has had a few near misses in his career with some very famous roles. So he was linked with playing Han Solo in the original Star Wars film. Apparently George Lucas suggested him for the film, but they obviously ended up with Harrison Ford. And then Irving Kershner offered him the chance to play Lando Calrissian in Empire Strikes Back, which, again, he didn't take. And then finally, he was offered the chance to play Jean-Luc Picard in Star Trek The Next Generation. Again, an opportunity he turned down. Mm. So we will cover Yaphet Kotto and Kananga in much more detail in Live and Let Die. But so Kotto sadly died a few years back. But before he did, he spoke to Big Issue in 2015 and did an interview. And he was asked about James Bond being recast with a non-white or a black actor. And Kotto said, "James Bond cannot be black. Political correctness be damned. We have to stay with what is literally correct. He was established by Ian Fleming as a white character, played by white actors. It's silly. Play 003 or 006, but you cannot be 007. A lot of people say we should be allowed to play everything. Don't be ridiculous. I say, if I want to play JFK, I should be laughed out of the room. Why should James Bond be black? It's silly." And obviously, I mean, James Bond's a fictional character. That's why it's different to JFK, but slightly different. But what his response to that was is, "I don't think it's right for black actors or writers to do roles that whites have made historically white heroic roles. These roles are not written for black men. Black men should stop trying to play white heroes. We have pens. Put a black man in a role that no one else has established." So obviously that sort of echoes what Barbara Broccoli has said about James Bond being a woman as well. So he makes a lot of interesting points there. I don't know if, I don't think he's completely wrong.
It's probably, the point that he said that, he was probably accurate, but things change, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Right. So, final Kevin Bacon of the night.
Yaphet Kotto. Who wants to go first?
I couldn't get it. I got halfway and then gave up.
Well, I also got halfway and then needed a bit of Wikipedia-ing to sort of help finish get my last jigsaw piece, I'm afraid.
Well, the only thing, the way that my process was, the only thing I really know that Yaphet Kotto was in that would have other people in that I could use was Alien.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the route I went down.
And then from Alien, I went for the sort of big group ensemble, which was Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah.
It was Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah, that's where
I went. And then I couldn't think of anyone. I couldn't think of any links from there.
Well, that's the route I went. And with a bit of snooping around, I found Bill Murray had a cameo at the end of the credits in She's Having a Baby.
Oh, that doesn't count. Wow.
But, you know, if
that's not in the spirit of six Degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Yaphet Kotto was in Midnight Run.
Right.
With Robert De Niro, who was in Sleepers with Kevin Bacon. So, it wasn't the most difficult one, but...
Well, unlike Brendan, I refuse to look at Wikipedia when I do these things.
but I've got a bonus, though.
Go on.
If you didn't accept She's Having a Baby, which you're clearly not. If not, you go with Wild Things instead.
You researched this, didn't you?
No. Well, right, I did research. Yeah, I researched it. I haven't seen it, but I needed it because I didn't get there. But the point is, I got Wild Things, which is Bill Murray and Kevin Bacon. But you get the bonus of Denise Richards. So surely, come on,
is that a bonus?
Yeah, that is on the James Bond podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
Well, that wraps up the letter K. Going by the alphabet, our next episode will be the letter L. Which we'll do a letter episode and then we'll open it up to a whole world of possibilities under that. We've got Lazenby, we've got Live and Let Die. It's going to be an epic few episodes to come. But thank you so much for listening. If people want to get in touch with the show, how do they get us on email?
podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
And on social media?
@jamesbondatoz on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook.
So while we go off and listen to Cooler Shaker and watch Bert Kwok,
Harry Hill
whilst eating a banana.
Yes, it just leaves me to say that the James Bond A to Z podcast will return next week.
Thank you all.
Ciao.
The James Bond A to Z podcast features Tom Butler, Brendan Duffy and Tom Wheatley. The podcast was produced by Tom Wheatley, with music by Tom Ingemels and artwork supplied by Helen Dolly.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.